The Athletic.
Hello, my name's Jack Pitbrook, and this is The View from the Lane, The Athletic's Tottenham Hotspur podcast. Our normal host, Danny Kelly, is away today, recuperating from a medical procedure at home in Ireland. We obviously wish him all the best. So I'm back in the chair, and I'm joined today by my Athletic colleagues, Charlie Eccleshare and James Moore. I think we're all very pleased to say that with the second of the autumn's three international breaks now almost out of the way, we are thrillingly near to the return of Premier League football and Tottenham Hotspur. The break, Charlie, isn't quite over yet because Giovanni Lo Celso and Cristian Romero are playing late tonight, 12:30 UK time, when Argentina hosts Peru. Charlie, are you going to stay up and watch it?
I think I'll give this one a miss, as tempting as it is. With a young child, sleep is precious. And as much as I want to see Lo Celso and Romero get on, I'm confident that someone will package everything good Lo Celso does into a handy two-minute clip on Twitter, which will make us all think he's amazing. So that's fine by me. I should say as well, on this, I was saying this to James yesterday, have a bit of a bugbear with, there's been so much back and forth about quarantining and red zones and all of this about Lo Celso and Romero. The main thing is they're playing on Friday morning, UK time. So that's the main issue with them playing on Sunday. They've always been okay to play that game, or they have been, you know, since a few weeks ago. You know, whether they had to quarantine or not, the rules were such that they could play. It's just that they're going to be knackered. They're playing, you know, that generally we accept, don't we, that Thursday to Sunday is that's kind of the tightest turnaround you can have. So I think Friday morning to Sunday would be a huge gamble on their fitness from Nuno.
It's mad that they play, by the way, hello everyone. It's mad that they play a game on like a Thursday night their time, isn't it? Ahead of like matches at the weekend. I mean, you would have thought like, they would have wanted to keep their players in Europe sweet. And I know, you know, we talked about this at the last international break, that these players are obviously absolutely desperate to play for their national team, which is great. But it does seem crazy that I think the first game they all played was on the first Thursday of the break. Then they played over the weekend, and then they are playing again tonight. It just seems like, move the whole thing forward one day, and it'll be fine, and you'll give these players the opportunity to play for their club teams. It just seems slightly unusual. Are they trying to make some kind of point? Who is it? It's not CONCACAF, is it? Who is it?
CONMEBOL.
CONMEBOL. Yeah, the scheduling is shambolic.
CONMEBOLICS, mate.
One of the annoying things about...
There's the title of the episode.
One of the weird things about this situation is that obviously UK government has now relaxed the rules, which means that they won't have to do a hotel quarantine. They can just do a kind of bubble within their Premier League clubs when they return for 10 days, but they can still play and train. But the problem is that because of that relaxation, it's now impossible for the clubs to say only play two games and then come back, which is what eventually happened in the last break. So obviously last time, Lo Celso, Romero, Sanchez played two games, then came back, obviously via Croatia. Whereas this time they're playing all three games, and that doesn't really work for Tottenham either, because even, you know, best case scenario, if they get on a flight, overnight Friday their time, so Friday lunchtime UK time, and they get back to the UK Saturday, they won't have trained. And the idea of them kind of going up to St James's Park and play, I mean, even if they can probably get them out on the field if they really wanted to, but I don't imagine they'll be in any fit state to play, unfortunately.
And there's Roy Allen Sanchez, who they're playing, what, Thursday night UK time?
Yeah, so Sanchez plays, so Colombia host Ecuador tonight, so that's 10 p.m. UK time Thursday night, and Emerson Royale's Brazil host Uruguay. I think that's kind of 1:30 a.m. Friday.
Yeah, you call them Emerson Royale's Brazil, but having looked, I think in the first two games he played 11 minutes. And Sanchez, by the way, in the first two games, he don't think played at all. So those two have schlepped all the way over to South America to not even kick a ball. But and again, this isn't like to do down like South American football. Absolutely not. And obviously these World Cup qualifiers are massive matches, and you know it's a very competitive group. But it just seems mad that they've shoehorned them in like this. You know, they paid this Copa America over the summer I think most people are in agreement it was a stupid idea, paying the whole thing behind closed doors. And now they're cramming in free qualifiers a month every month through the whole season. It just seems absolutely insane.
And the annoying thing is also that because of the way that CONMEBOL qualifying works, the tension goes out of it for the best teams quite quickly. And Argentina are doing pretty well now, and I imagine they'll get the 3 points allocated from that game that got called off in Brazil. at which point it's going to become kind of increasingly pointless for them to keep going back for another three games in November, this made-up international break in January, February, which isn't even a recognised break.
March. Like a recognised centre-forward.
Like that non-canon Bond film.
Yes, Never Say Never Again.
Yeah, it's a non-canonical international break. And so I'm afraid this story is going to run and run and run through this season, even though it is actually getting quite boring. Another story that's running and running and running is questions about Harry Kane's form. I was at the England game on Tuesday night against Hungary, and I thought he was pretty poor, to be honest, Kane. It was kind of the performance we've seen quite a bit of from Kane this year, like not really physically involved in the game, not really able to exert much pressure on the opposition or win the ball. And when he did get it, I think it kind of would get tangled up under his feet a few times and he gave away possession. And given the way that England played with these two kind of creative number eights in Mount and Foden, it just seemed to kind of clog up the whole system. You know, if you're going to play two eights like that, you don't want a centre forward who's coming back slowly towards them. You want someone like a kind of Rashford or Greenwood going in behind. James, did you watch it? And did you get a sense that this is kind of the Kane that we've seen a bit too much of recently?
I mean, yes and no. I thought, in the last game we played for Tottenham against Aston Villa, I thought he played pretty well, actually. I think we talked about it at the time. He didn't have loads of chances and he snatched at a couple he did get. And it probably felt like quite a rare thing for him, there being a sense that he was actually kind of conscious of the fact that he hadn't scored a goal this season, which I really don't like. I think the thing I've said before, he seems to be impervious to the sort of game state in the occasion and whatever else. And he would genuinely always play the same way. And I think actually this season it has felt slightly different. But I actually think the big thing for England, and you talked about you mentioned this on the piece that you wrote off the back of the game, was because he and Sterling are both off form. Sterling is the only player in that team who would run beyond Kane if he drops off. And for whatever reason, that wasn't quite happening in that game.
It's because Sterling was pushed down to the right. So Sterling, it's much easier for Sterling to make those runs when he starts on the left, but he's been shifted out to the right to accommodate Grealish. Now he hasn't got that same angle.
So there you go. And it just, you know, there's no one running beyond Kane. So when he did drop off and occasionally get the ball, which actually didn't happen that often, that there's no one running beyond him to play in. So he was kind of dropping off and getting in the way of Foden and Mount, because obviously they're brilliant technical players who play in those kind of areas as well. And then there was no one really playing the kind of balls that he likes in like the final third. So he just wasn't really getting the ball. And this isn't me saying it wasn't his fault and he wasn't bad, because he definitely was. But I do think there's kind of some mitigation in the way that system didn't quite work for whatever reason.
Do you think, like, because I did a piece during the Euros when obviously Kane didn't score in the groups and then he did score against Germany, and I did a piece looking at previous droughts in inverted commas he's had and the fact that he then often goes on a scoring tear, and obviously he did that at the Euros. And it was quite interesting reading the quotes at the time from all of those droughts, which he has, you know, let's say once a year or something. And it is like eerily similar, the pattern that, you know, he doesn't look fit, you know, he's not even getting the chances, he's dropping too deep, is this the end for Kane? And honestly, we've seen that
On this podcast, I reckon.
Yeah.
When would it have been? After the restart in 2020. I reckon we were having, and it, when he looked finished then, he looked cooked then, completely done. And then you come back to the following season, last season now, and he's a top scorer in the Premier League and a top assist provider as well. And
completely.
I know you can argue that he had a good season last season, even if Spurs didn't.
Ditto when he started slowly in kind of the summer of 2015 in that 15-16 season, and it was all second season syndrome, as he even found out. I mean, it's happened again and again and again. Obviously, the fear of Tottenham fans and England fans is that eventually it will bleed into something longer, but all evidence so far suggests it won't, and that he'll score again, go on a great run, and everyone's and this is forgotten. One thing I wanted to ask, though, is do you think... Does Kane get more... I've always felt with Kane there's a bit of like suspicion around him, because he was a late developer, you know, he wasn't hyped up. There's always been this slight feeling like, oh, maybe he is going to get found out. And, you know, does he get more of that, or do you think that's just inevitable because he's an elite level centre forward and that happens to any striker who's that good who doesn't score?
I mean, maybe Alan Shearer didn't really ever have those runs without a goal, I guess. But I don't remember, or like Aguero or Henry or anyone. I mean, I guess Henry... as a sort of prolific goal scorer, maybe that did come a bit later for him as well. Not, you know, late in his career, but it wasn't from the age of 18, was it?
Yeah.
It was like sort of second, third season at Arsenal. So no, you don't really hear that. I don't remember hearing that about other players. I mean, even someone like Rooney, who like obviously wasn't as prolific, but kind of had a similar sort of profile as like a key England player. And he obviously had quite a steep decline in the last few years of his career. But even then, I don't really remember there being like the questions asked about whether he was finished, when perhaps in retrospect he actually was.
Rooney got probably quite generous coverage, I think, in the sort of back end of his career. You know, people would kind of talk themselves into saying that he was better than he was. You know, he's got to go to Euro 2016.
Play midfield,
Play midfield. Even that, like in hindsight, that was a bad decision from Hodgson.
Given a free role under Allardyce.
I think Rooney seemed to have a bit more credit in the bank than Kane did for whatever reason. I guess I see what Charlie means, but I guess Charlie, like, the worrying thing is, I mean, how long is a blip allowed to go on? Because it's now mid-October. I know he missed the first week of pre-season, but he started 11 games so far this season. He's not really looked right in any of them. And at what point do you say, actually, maybe something has changed fundamentally? And it's
missing that bit of pre-season, by the way, that isn't just a caveat. That is like a big part of why this has happened, isn't it? Surely.
Well, yeah, up to a point, but that was 2 months ago.
But we know he's like a slow starter in the season. If you take out like actually having a pre-season and playing friendly matches and being in proper training up, you know, more than 5 days before the start of the season, I mean, surely that's going to have an impact.
You would think so, especially given, you know, a really carefully managed pre-season, etc., would be all the more necessary after a crazily constricted season and then straight into a Euros in which his team reaches the final and off the back of Project Restart when he was coming back from a serious injury. I mean, all of those things really would need a very precise, and look, we know that Kane is so motivated and dedicated that it's not like he was just chilling in Disneyland not doing anything, but there is still a difference having a full and proper pre-season.
This isn't a criticism, but and you're right in what you say about him being like a highly motivated professional, but I have just a slight inkling, a sense that like that motivation may, even if only temporarily, may have been sort of diminished slightly. Like
in that August period.
Without wanting to sound like making him sound like a kind of thespian, like what is his motivation now? Do you know what I mean? Like is he proving himself to get the move to Manchester City next year? Is he trying to break Jimmy Greaves' goalscoring record at Tottenham? I mean, what is it that's, you know, I just have a slight sense that he might be sort of a little bit, I'm not saying this would be permanent either, but I do wonder whether he's like, that hunger that he had before may have slightly been dented by the fact he's basically a Tottenham team now going backwards.
But I don't think I don't think he's someone who's needed that necessarily. Like, he's the kind of guy to me who, he's so single-minded that whatever, I was saying this to Jack actually at the Chelsea game, that even when it's like defending near post corners, and you know, a part of him might be thinking like, fucking hell, this is beneath me. I'm an elite goal scorer playing for a team that's currently mid-table getting battered by Chelsea and I'm defending near post corners. But he was doing it seemingly with relish, because he's the kind of guy, you give him a task, go on, go and win that header and he'll fucking go on and do it. And I kind of feel the same with goal scoring. I don't think he necessarily needs... Obviously, ideally, he would be in a team that are really pushing for titles and things. But like you saw when he came on, you know, against NS Moura, I don't think he's thinking, what am I doing? I'm spending my Thursday nights playing in this rubbish competition. He goes on and like an animal scores three times.
By the way, I have no doubts. Like he'll score 30 goals this season in all competitions between England and Spurs. Absolutely no question. And he'll get 18 Premier League goals maybe or whatever. I have no doubt about that. But I do... Yeah, I do wonder slightly whether he might just be in a bit of a funk still, and that we're just waiting for something to kind of kickstart his season. And by the way, when that happens, I think Spurs will be laughing, because I think actually, you know, you'll see like a huge improvement in every player in the team when that happens.
Totally. I think the evidence of just what we see with our eyes probably suggests that James is right, I think. Like, I think he has looked a bit off it. I mean, he has just looked off it. Whether that's mental or physical, I don't know, or a combination of the two.
To me, that's... I would imagine, and again, I respect that, I don't know, but that to me would be more just a physical thing, because I just never think he's anything other than just so desperate to score goals. And
I just think it's a bit of both. I mean, I just think, you know, and it's sort of understandable to a degree, isn't it?
Yeah, I think it is totally understandable. It's been a pretty, you know, we don't need to go into the reasons for it again, but he has had a pretty tough summer.
But there is also, like, when you say, Jack, how long... I mean, I know you mean in the sense of, like, how long before we kind of make that judgment as to whether this is something to be worried about or not. But there is a fundamental difference with England and Spurs as well, because for England, there are actually legitimate options and alternatives, whereas that just doesn't really exist. But I mean, what?
Yeah, Spurs can't play.
Yeah, exactly. What are they going to do if he goes... You know, it's not like they're going to be like, right, let's drop Kane for the United game or something.
Yeah, well, though I think James, you're both right that if he starts scoring, you know, if he starts scoring, I think he will just keep scoring.
That's,
you know,
what history suggests, that he does tend to go on these streaks after.
And it might well be that it's at St James's Park this Sunday where he does that. Kane scored two goals in each of Spurs' last two games there. Spurs actually have a surprisingly good record at SJP ever since that really bad defeat on the
SJP.
Why
do you have to give initials to stuff? That's
they won three because I've got initials as well, so I'm used to. So for me, everything is initializable. You know, I live in an initials world. But they've won three and drawn one of the last four league games. And even though, you know, no one would say that Spurs are playing well at the moment. Do you reckon they could get something this Sunday against Newcastle, who are in this unique
position?
They
did play well against Villa, by the way. I thought really impressive how they played against Villa. Actually, I mean, maybe the international break was actually quite badly timed then, with that in mind. I don't know, it's an odd one, because obviously it's going to be a quote-unquote emotional day at St James's Park, SJP as you call it. But it does feel like one of those ones where obviously by the time people listen to this, Steve Bruce may have been sacked, but that dragging on for the whole week is really weird. I mean, whatever they do now is going to feel a bit odd. I mean, even if they end up with Graham Jones in charge for the game, you know, Steve Bruce having been there as manager all week in the build-up, I don't know, it's very strange. And ultimately, Newcastle do still have, what are they, 18th, 17th in the league?
Yeah, I mean, they haven't won a game. Like, yeah. as much as this is long-term, obviously going to be transformative, there's nothing really, you know, is there a new ownership bounce? Have the numbers been run on that? You know,
it feels like it could go either way, that, doesn't it?
Totally.
Like, you know, these players all know that, in all probability, you know, this football club might win trophies in the next few years, but more likely than not, these players are probably not going to be involved in that. I mean, maybe one or two. Maybe someone like, you know, Callum Wilson can hang around, or Dubravka or whatever. I mean, maybe someone ends up being part of it. But I'm not necessarily convinced that Jonjo Shelvey is going to be a Premier League winner, say.
No, I mean, and you know, often with these games, you know, it might be one where they lose, and it's a sign to MBS of the scale of the task on his hands with these players. I mean, like, ultimately they're still not a very good team. They could, you know, and if they do get beaten, it'll be like, oh yeah, of course. Well, despite everything that's happened, it's still the same players and the same manager. Or if it's not the same manager, it's not exactly Antonio Conte coming in and firing this team up.
Yeah, there's kind of no way to know really what the atmosphere will be like. I'm sure it'll be full, and I'm sure it'll be very positive at the start. But equally, there's a lot of Newcastle fans who wanted Steve Bruce to get sacked this week. And so, you know, we're recording this on Thursday.
That's the thing that could work in Spurs' favour, actually. If he's in the dugout and Spurs start well, or if Spurs go in front maybe, then that kind of toxicity could kind of still kind of permeate a bit. You do wonder about that. I mean, obviously, the atmosphere is going to be far better than it would have been had Ashley Steele been at the club, and you suspect that will probably have a bearing on the way Newcastle start the game, I would imagine.
Yeah, but at the same time, if Newcastle throw if like the crowd are really positive and they throw people forward,
exactly,
then that's exactly what Spurs want them to do. You know, the one thing we saw in the Aston Villa game, Spurs are really good on the break because they got Son, who's the best counter-attacker in the Premier League.
So. By the way, the results Newcastle have got against Spurs have mostly been down at White Hart Lane, where they've like sat in and like goalkeepers have made loads of saves and whatever. Tim Krul, yeah, exactly. Maybe you're right, actually, Jack. If Newcastle are encouraged to throw everything at Spurs, that might actually work in their favour.
Can we talk about, on the running order, it's there, the precedent for this, which is the first City game under Abu Dhabi, and the 3-1 defeat to Chelsea, because that's so in the sweet spot of nostalgia. I mean, I remember that game really vividly. That it was a deflected free kick.
It kind of clipped the wall. Then went in. Everybody went absolutely crazy. And then it was like quite early on in Scolari's tenure when they had Deco and Bissouma was playing brilliantly at right back,
and it looked like he was going to be really good for them, Scolari. So they won like 4-0 in his first game.
They just destroyed City in the second half, because obviously it was a pretty, you know, it was only Mark Hughes's, I think, maybe fourth league game in charge. And they had a pretty like patched together team with a mix of kind of kids and people who'd arrived that summer. And
there are some surprise names on that team sheet, just looking at it here.
That City team was quite good. Because City had that like year in between with Taxing, where like they'd brought in Alano and Chorluka and, you know, I mean, Chorluka had gone by then, I guess. But, you know, they kind of had like a year in between. They're going from being like a sort of relegation scrappers to being quite a good team. So it wasn't like they kind of went, like Newcastle are going to have to do, going from being like one of the very worst teams in the league to suddenly having like Rubinho's and whoever else, Coutinho's, to be suspected.
Mm-hmm.
Newcastle don't have a kind of on the pitch figurehead like City had with Rubinho.
Yes, for the start
of this, it's going to be two. The fact is, it's still going to be the same bunch of players who've conceded 16 goals in 7 Premier League games so far this season. So in that sense, I think there's not really anything for Tottenham to be worried about.
Jack, how many of the City 11 do you reckon you can name?
So I reckon it would have been... So the back four would have been something like Richards, Dunn, Taubenheim,
no.
Ball...
Ball is correct. Yeah, I'm really surprised he was still there.
Was Kompany not there?
Kompany was there. Kompany was
playing midfield though, I imagine.
Possibly. Yeah, he's down.
Kompany played in midfield that season. So it would have been what? Not Dunn and Benheim at centre back.
No, it looks like it must have been Richards at centre back with Dunn.
But then who at right
Ball
back?
Ball left back, and then right back. Again, someone you wouldn't necessarily have thought was already there.
Zabaleta.
Yeah.
Yeah, so Zabaleta arrived that some earlier.
When Zabaleta
that
had
Spaniel.
Hair.
Yeah, then Zabaleta had hair.
Then in midfield, I reckon it would have been Kompany and either Johnson or Haman and Ireland.
Haman and Ireland.
This is great content for a Spurs podcast, by the way. This,
yeah, sorry guys. I'm really sorry to all our listeners. Maybe we should cut this out. And then it would have, up front would have been, was it still Emil Mpenza?
No, another. It was a different...
Joe,
yeah.
Joe Rubinho, and then on the right, Sean Wright Phillips?
Yeah, correct.
And in goal, either Hart or Schmeichel.
This is bringing it to Spurs.
The Hart dog?
Yeah.
Shall we do the 11 from when Spurs won at the Etihad? Oh, wouldn't it be called the Etihad then, would it? What would it have been called? City of Manchester Stadium.
City of Manchester Stadium.
In like November of that season. Shall we do the Spurs 11? I'm not going to really get it.
Oh, that's the Huddleston goal, isn't it? Oh, no, Huddleston goal. No. Take that back.
Darren Bent.
It's Darren
Bent.
Sorry. Huddleston was 2006. Take it back.
Gomez?
Yes.
Chorluka?
Yes.
Ooh. Dawson?
Noah.
Woodgate.
He's on the bench.
Woodgate,
yeah.
King?
Yeah.
Asu Okoto?
Yeah. Who you'll remember was sent off in the 89th minute.
Yeah. Did Richard Dunn get sent off as well?
He did. Yeah. As did a third.
I'm not going to get it. Gelson Fernandes?
Yes.
Oh, come on! right. Wilson Palacios? No, not Wilson Palacios. It's before Palacios. Modric?
Yep.
Huddleston?
Yep.
Genus?
Yep.
It won't be Bale. Dos Santos?
No. God, this is quite weird.
Lennon? Aaron Lennon?
No, he came on for Modric.
So, Fraser Campbell?
No.
Bent, anyway, definitely Bent.
Bent, yeah. So you're missing two players.
Super Path?
No.
So it's quite a defensive
team for Harry Redknapp.
Okay, must be another. Is it another defensive midfielder? Didier Zakora.
Yeah, and then you've got one more player to get. I've interviewed him for The Athletic.
It's not Pascal Chimbonda because he didn't come back then. It's not Timo Tanya because he had gone. I don't know, he's gone.
David Bentley.
Ah, of course. Yeah, fine. Well, that was fun.
Coming up after the break, we'll be taking another look at the Newcastle takeover.
This episode is supported by Season 3 of FX's Welcome to Wrexham. Celebrity owners Rob McElhenney and Ryan Reynolds' small-town Welsh football club has finally been promoted into League 2 after 15 seasons in the National League. Dedicated staff and supporters celebrate the city's return to glory while bracing for the newfound challenges that come with being in a higher division. Will Wrexham AFC stand up to the challenges and rise again into League 1? FX's Welcome to Wrexham premieres May 2nd on FX. Stream on Hulu.
This episode is brought to you by Michelob Ultra, the official beer sponsor of the NBA. Want to get closer to the game than ever before? Michelob Ultra Courtside is giving fans the chance to win exclusive NBA prizes and experiences like official gear, courtside seats to an NBA game, and more. Head over to MichelobUltra.com/courtside to learn more.
So I think the question of the morality of the Newcastle takeover by Saudi Arabia has really dominated this international break, as I think it probably will do for English football over the next few years. This is something we've covered in depth at The Athletic. This morning we've got a new story by Joey Durso just about how ludicrous the claim is that the public investment fund is in any way separate from the Saudi Arabian state. But we've also just run a survey of Spurs fans asking the question that we've touched on in previous podcasts, which is, what would they think if Tottenham were to be sold to Saudi Arabia? Charlie, you put this survey up. Can you tell us about it?
Yeah, I mean, we just had this idea because obviously they're playing each other this weekend. And also it just feels like Spurs with their like self-sustaining model is so at odds with this takeover that's just going to come in and, you know, seemingly transform Newcastle overnight. And we wanted to get a sense of from Spurs fans how they would feel, yeah, if this happened to them. Would they want this to happen? You know, that was our first question, was would you rather Spurs have their current ownership structure or Newcastle's? And so once the results are all in, we're going to write a piece on this that will, I think, be up on The Athletic on Saturday. But like the initial...
exit poll.
The exit poll, exactly, suggests that... the Spurs fans would far rather have the current structure than Newcastle's, which is quite interesting. And, you know, reading the comments under the article, and I've had a lot of interaction on social media, you know, that is down to the fact that they wouldn't want to be associated with a regime like Saudi Arabia. This is quite interesting, though, that so far, 60% of fans say they would keep going to games if they were taken over by an equivalent, 40% saying that they would stop going to games, which I think is quite interesting, you know, and that's, you know, that's obviously a big debating point that we discussed with Danny last week, I think, as well, as to whether he would stop going to games. And James, I'll want to get your view on that in a second as well. And then talk about, as you know, one of the questions goes into how, you know, is it about winning at all costs? Does who owns the club matter? And again, that's pretty split, not quite down the middle. I think it was something like, so this was, yeah, this was asking about, as long as Spurs are successful, I'm not bothered about who owns the club. And about 40% of people said, yeah, I'm not really bothered about who owns the club as long as we're successful. But then, you know, around 60 said, I am bothered, you know, that sort of stuff does matter to me. So just thought it was interesting to get and maybe, you know, we view everything, I guess, through a Spurs prism, and probably every Premier League club has strong views on the Newcastle takeover and how it affects them. But it did feel like Spurs are such a counterpoint to it. And with them playing each other on the weekend, you've got, it just feels quite fitting. But yeah, I mean, James, what's your view on that? Would you stop going to games?
Yeah, I mean, if it was an oppressive regime like this, where like the human rights issues are unavoidable, I would definitely want to have like no involvement in that. And I would be very strongly against that. I mean, to be honest, for me, like regardless of where the money's coming from, and you know, I know you'd say there are no billionaires who aren't at least slightly morally dubious. After everything that's happened over the last few years with Spurs, and I mean like 6-7 years, the idea of someone coming in just pumping a load of cash in and then winning stuff after all that, I wouldn't like that, even if it was kind of all above board. Do you know what I mean? I just kind of feel like they came so close to doing it the right way, if you want to call it that. But like the idea that they'd like go again and do it with like the sort of, you know, the cheat code. Sort of, I don't think I'd really enjoy that. I mean, maybe I'd feel really differently about that if you'd asked me that question in 2016. Not the kind of the ethical side of the non-sporting stuff, but just with regards to the amount of money being spent and where that money's coming from. I don't know. Now I just kind of feel like that wouldn't really interest me. Like that wouldn't do it for me. Like someone coming in and pumping in hundreds of million pounds to spend on players every summer. You know, this thing at Chelsea where, you know, they signed Timo Werner last summer for 15 million quid or whatever it was. It's quite a good deal, but it obviously doesn't work out for whatever reason, or not as well as you would hope, or they would hope. And then like the very next summer, they go out and spend, what was it, 90 million pounds on Lukaku because that didn't work out. Like, can you imagine if Spurs had spent 50 million pounds on a striker?
Yeah. How big a thing that would be, whether he was a success or a failure.
I mean, they spent £30 million on Soldado and it obviously didn't work out. And like they were only bailed out by the miracle of Harry Kane coming out, like kind of coming off the bench or coming out of the reserves at that exact moment.
Yeah.
You know, they would have been absolutely knackered. Why shouldn't they? He wouldn't have been able to replace Soldado. He would have like been forcing Soldado into the team for a couple of years after that, probably. So yeah, it just doesn't, I don't know. It's to me, I mean, that's not, I think I necessarily expect other people to agree with. But for me, it wouldn't appeal to me, really.
That's really interesting, actually. So you, in the sense that they just wouldn't go for a Pochettino 2014 equivalent.
Just the idea, I don't know, I just don't like the idea of it. I like it all being done that quickly and like big money being, and like all those corners kind of being cut and, you know, just being able to bring it, not kind of finding clever solutions and just like going out and buying like elite players, like ready-made players and chucking loads of money at them and it all kind of feeling a bit,
yeah,
you know, a bit dirty. I'm, you know, this isn't like, I'm not criticising fans of other clubs who have been in that situation or fans of Spurs who in that situation would love it. But for me, I just wouldn't, that wouldn't do it for me now. And like I said, I may have felt very differently about that before the whole Pochettino thing. And also even going back that period of time since then, you've seen obviously Leicester win the league and the FA Cup. And obviously well documented that that's been done through good recruitment more than anything else and a bit of luck. And Liverpool as well, like winning the European Cup and the Premier League. And we know they have spent money, but not like, you know, oil state levels. Like sensible reinvestment in what they've sold as well. So yeah, I just that wouldn't appeal for me at all. That wouldn't be like, you know, I wouldn't like if some mad billionaire wanted to chuck loads of money at it and he didn't have the issues that Saudi Arabia have got. I wouldn't be like a moral objection necessarily. I wouldn't like stop supporting Spurs or stop going, but I wouldn't. I don't think it would do it for me. I don't think that would work for me.
Even if James, that was kind of the only way that Tottenham could win the league. Because I think the Tottenham, like the Pochettino, I really don't want to get back into another look back in the sort of 2016-17
era
again. But that one of the reasons why Tottenham had the chance to win the Premier League that year is that all the big clubs were, or in that kind of Pochettino window, was all the big clubs were kind of in, sorry, the rich clubs were kind of in flux at that moment. You know, City were, Guardiola just showed up at City, Klopp had just shown up at Liverpool, they were kind of getting up to speed, United were in a bit of turmoil. Chelsea didn't really know what they were doing at that point. And so, until they got Conte, you know, in between Mourinho and Conte. Whereas now it feels...
But Chelsea had a crap season after... They had a crap season with Conte and a relatively crap season after Conte as well. So it's not supposed to finish above Chelsea that season after Chelsea won the league, right? Under Conte.
City and Liverpool have raised the bar in the last sort of four years in a way which actually makes it much harder for a kind of Pochettino redo to be viable.
But the kind of thing Liverpool have done, it should be, and I know Liverpool are a bigger club than Spurs and they will have bigger commercial revenues than Spurs, but that is the kind of thing they should be aspiring to more than like trying to be, you know, hope someone will come in and pump in £500 million in transfer fees and wages every summer.
I guess though the thing is now, the sad reality now is that you getting that kind of mad investment is no longer even a cheat code. You could argue that all that is true. It would put you on a par with three of the other clubs in the division. So that might soften your kind of feelings of sort of grubbiness. Because you could justify it as, well, we're just amongst, you know, the four clubs who do this as well. We've just done
that
the best.
That tells you a lot about the Premier League, though, doesn't it?
It does.
That being the case, I'm not saying you're wrong.
Yeah, but, and it's a horrible reality.
That is going to be a thing that Newcastle are going to find, I think. That it's not, like you say, not the cheat code, actually, that... No, with City and Chelsea already so established, obviously Manchester United make money hand over fist for selling duvet covers and whatever else. You know, it's going to be very difficult for Newcastle probably to even get in the top four. Like,
really difficult in the short term.
I mean, you know, if they're chucking hundreds of millions of pounds at it every single year, eventually they'll get there. But yeah, it's not going to be like, you know, even City in the first season, by the way, didn't get in the Champions League, did they? And they didn't win a trophy for, 3 years and didn't win the league for
until 2011.
So it's not like...
And they didn't qualify for Champions League to 2011, right?
Yeah, exactly. And everyone, City are deemed the example of how you do this and how you run a club in that sense. But, I mean, it wasn't like an immediate thing for them, was it?
I think we touched on this last week, but it's just much harder for Newcastle simply because other teams have already done it.
Yeah, exactly.
Like, City and Chelsea are in place now. And that means that, you know, I think Newcastle, I'm sure they can spend their way to being better than West Ham and maybe eventually Leicester and maybe even Arsenal, Tottenham. But actually breaking into the top four is just really, really difficult. And I think I mentioned this last week, but look at Everton. You know, Everton, Mashiri's been trying to spend Everton's way into the top four for the last 5 years. They've bought some pretty good players. You know, Decore, was a great buy. There've been plenty of other. Richarlison's been fantastic. They've bought well. They've appointed a series of pretty good managers, and they're still miles off. You know, they're getting further away, not closer. And I just want, you know, so for Newcastle to do it better than Everton, they will have to spend a lot more money and be a lot more intelligent.
Well, that's the thing. Yeah, you need to appoint the right people. I mean, what City have done is, as well as obviously spending ridiculous sums of money on players, they have got the appointments for those, yeah, sporting director, all of those sorts of things spot on, and all of that part, that long-term strategy to woo Guardiola. And that's almost what you have to do. But you are putting yourself in a position where if you get smart people in who make good decisions, you will become very, very good. Whether it takes 5 years or 10 years, it just will happen.
I'm Adam Hurry, and to mark the 100th episode of my Football Clichés podcast, Jamie Carragher popped in to discuss his footballing fascinations and irritations on the latest edition of Mesut Haaland Dicks. It's like Desert Island Discs, but for football.
I played for England as a striker.
Really?
Don't look so shocked.
I am shocked. And, I watched you at the 1997 Amsterdam Sony Sixes. I can't believe this.
Whether this is a feather in my cap or not, I was keeping Emile Heskey out of England under 16s, Steve. He was on the
that
bench.
Is a feather in your cap.
And all the other teams are doing proper warm-ups, and we were just bladdering balls at the wall and having shots and just causing mayhem. And we've just gone out with no sort of like formation, anything. It's just like, just go out and play, like whatever. And, you know, it was just an absolute disaster, but funny in a way.
How is Elhad Stuf these days, Jamie? How is he doing?
Yeah, I don't know. Yeah, he rates me really highly.
To listen to Jamie in full flow, check out Football Clichés wherever you get your pods. And of course, ad-free on The Athletic.
Looking for an assist with your credit card but can't get a hold of anyone? Luckily, with 24/7 US-based live customer service from Discover, everyone has the option to talk to a real person anytime, day or night. Yep, you heard that right. You can talk to a real human in customer service at any time. Sounds like a real game changer if you ask us. Make the right call and get the service you deserve with Discover. Limitations apply. See terms at discover.com/creditcard. As you've probably heard by now, we've teamed up with BetMGM this season. We'll be using BetMGM lines to make all of our picks, and we'll have special offers for our listeners each week. If you haven't signed up for BetMGM yet, use bonus code THEATHLETIC, and you'll get a one-year subscription to The Athletic, plus up to a $1,500 first bet offer on your first wager with BetMGM. Here's how it works. Download the BetMGM app and sign up using bonus code THEATHLETIC. Make your first deposit of at least $10, place your first bet on any game, and claim your voucher for a one-year subscription to The Athletic. See BetMGM.com for terms. U.S. promotional offers not available in D.C., Mississippi, New York, Nevada, Ontario, or Puerto Rico. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER. Available in the U.S. Call 877-8-HOPE-NY or text HOPE-NY-467-369 in New York. Call 1-800-NEXT-STEP in Arizona. 1-800-327-5050 in Massachusetts. 1-800-BETS-OFF in Iowa. 1-800-270-7117 for confidential help in Michigan. 1-800-981-0023 in Puerto Rico. First bet offer for new customers only in partnership with Kansas Crossing Casino and Hotel. Don't forget, if you haven't signed up for BetMGM yet, use bonus code THEATHLETIC and you'll get a one-year subscription to The Athletic, plus up to a $1,500 first bet offer on your first wager.
So one of the stories rumbling this season, kind of in the background, is the fact that Harry Winks is still at Tottenham, but not really any closer to being a big part of their plans than he was last year. Charlie, you've just done a piece saying that after staying to fight for his place this summer, you wonder whether this January might be the time for him to go.
Yeah, certainly on loan. I think that's got to be a big consideration. Just thinking what's best for the club and for the player. And around this time last year, I wrote a piece saying why I thought he should stay, because I thought he should fight for his place, that Lo Celso and Ndombele, Aurier had all shown under Mourinho that, you know, things can change very quickly. And actually, Winks did then. He started three straight games in December and January in the Premier League and looked very briefly like, oh, maybe he will become a starter again. But then it fell away under Mourinho, who... You know, never. It always felt like that was quite an uncomfortable fit. And then it's that's just carried on really under Nuno. And part of the reason we felt this piece was timely is it's now 3 years, almost exactly, I think 3 years tomorrow, since that Spain game, the Nations League game where England won 3-2, Wink started. Southgate was glowing about him in the build-up, talking about him as, you know, the future of England, the England team. Pochettino around the same time was saying similar things. And I mean, Pochettino rated him so highly, it's easy to forget that like he started the Champions League final having been out for almost 2 months with a groin injury that requires surgery. I mean, we think about Kane starting that final, but that was, you know, a pretty big leap of faith starting Winks as well. And yeah, I think, you know, just looking at it, it feels like it's just gone a bit stagnant for him at Tottenham. And last year, I used a bunch of examples of players who left big six teams and then never really got back to that level, and talked about people like Tom Cleverley from Manchester United, or like Kieran Gibbs in Iwobi at Arsenal. And there are tons of those sort of examples. But actually, looking at how Lingard kind of revitalised his career with that loan spell at West Ham, and even someone like Martin Odegaard from Real Madrid at Arsenal, I just feel like, you know, that might be what's needed. And that will give us more of a sense of whether, you know, is Winks' decline at Tottenham because his levels got worse, or is it because he's just been with managers who his quite particular skill set doesn't really mesh that well with them. So yeah, that's my view on it. And you know, an interesting topic in my view, just because he is a homegrown player. We've talked about it before, this slightly weird thing where rather that sort of holding credit for him, it seems to be a stick to beat him with, that he is from the academy. So yeah, an interesting talking point, and it'll be one to keep an eye on in January, see where that develops. Because Spurs have always been very reluctant to let him go.
What do you expect will happen? Do you think they would let him go on loan?
I don't know. I mean, last year they didn't, because they just couldn't take the risk of players getting injuries and then them being short. And I slightly feel like the same thing might happen. I think they'll be very resistant because, again, it slightly depends on what system Nuno settles on. But you've got Skip and Højbjerg as first choice. Now, if they're playing that 4-2-3-1, and then obviously at the moment you put Lo Celso and Ndombele ahead of him in the pecking order. But if he's really wedded to that system, if you sell Winks, you are then a little bit short there, or if you loan him rather. So I don't know, I feel like it could be a tricky one, and it just depends whether Spurs see enough of an upside in the long term to offset the risk in the short term. And we know they've had a history of not wanting to sell or loan players when perhaps they should have done.
Yeah, I mean, I mean quite aside from the fact that, you know, having fringe players who are homegrown is pretty useful in terms of like squad building, particularly when you're in Europe, I do wonder whether he was like a more suitable player when Spurs are a better team, if you know what I mean. Like him kind of like being there, kind of keeping things ticking over, you know, recycling the ball, just like picking it up and shifting it out to the better players. When Spurs were a good team and had Son Eriksen, Dele, Kane all kind of at the peak of their powers.
And Dembele next to
him. Dembele as well. And I guess there's probably less asked of him. And now I think Spurs probably need someone a bit more dominant in midfield, if you know what I mean. And he just isn't, you know, he's combative and he'll put himself about. He's not someone who dominate a midfield. He's not going to like, you know, be in a midfield battle with, I don't know, the best midfield players in the league and really lay a glove on them, is he? I don't think. So he's probably been a victim of, and this isn't, you know, to make an excuse for him, but he's probably been a victim of Spurs' decline to a certain degree with that in mind.
Mm.
But yeah, you're right. I mean, he's just not a player whose skill set is suited to the way Spurs are going to try and play now. And, you know, we've talked about Dele Alli in a similar way. And I actually think it's hard to imagine that it's going to swing back in his favour. I mean, I could be wrong, but I'm just not sure there's going to be a kind of... But what kind of team would he get? And I know he was linked with Man City and Manchester United, and clearly those clubs rate him, but they haven't actually come in for a proper bid, have they? And I just, you know, I just can't see there being a... Maybe he'll go abroad, but I do think it'll be difficult for him to find a decent club.
But what if, hypothetically, Nuno were to get sacked at some point, either this season or at the end of the season, and then get replaced by somebody who plays more of a sort of pressing, passing style? Because, you know, let's say, you know, counterfactually, what if Tottenham have got a Potter or Hansi Flick or Erik ten Hag this summer instead of Nuno, which were all, you know, all people who they looked at and who they could have got? Why do you think that would have changed? I mean, do you think Winks could have been revitalised under a manager who played a more amenable style to him? Or do you think it's kind of somehow just gone?
I suspect most of those managers would be looking to upgrade in central midfield.
Yeah, maybe. I think that is an interesting one, though. And that's probably why, from his point of view, a loan makes the most sense. Because I don't think many people think Nuno's going to be there for years and years and years. So it's almost like, okay, well, let's see if I can almost wait this out. And you hear that sort of thing from players all the time because, you know, managerial changes are so commonplace. And that's partly why last year I did say I thought leaving and taking a step down is a risk, because I do think, James, you're right, that he is better suited to that better team in a way. Like, I think it and also it's really hard to... The way that Winks plays... It's hard to stand out in a sense, because what he does is kind of invisible. It's neat and tidy. It's keeping things ticking over. And you need then other players around you who can then elevate themselves. I mean,
how does he take that step to go to one of those teams now? Do you know what I mean? It's like he's going to have to take a step backwards and play regularly for someone else. But unless he gets, you know, if he went to Brighton, maybe it would work. If he was at Brighton and they were doing well and they had a season where they finished sixth, and then maybe it feels like he could then step up again. But I find it hard to imagine a situation where he takes a step back and then takes a step forward. And I know you were saying, Charlie, that you wrote about that last year and then Lingard has subsequently happened and then maybe you feel slightly differently about it. But for a player like him, you know, Lingard's a goal scorer. And Lingard got everyone's attention at West Ham because he scored, like 8 goals or whatever it was and got 6 assists or whatever it was, mad numbers. Winks is never going to do that. He's never going to make that kind of impact, like you say. I don't know, it's very difficult to imagine, like his best chance, genuinely, I think, of being like a Champions League player again is going to be like kind of stumbling into it at Spurs somehow. But I just don't see how that's going to happen.
Yeah, I guess the two things that could happen, the equivalent of that for him could be either he moves abroad and... you know, finds a team and a system and a league that is a bit more suited to him. Or, as you say, he goes to Brighton or a Brentford, and in that environment, even if he's not getting the goals and assists, he's doing enough to make perhaps the Spurs manager next season, whoever that might be, say, yeah, okay, well, this guy's back. He's back playing with confidence. He can fit in. You know, he's someone who I can just slot into my system and he won't let me down. He'll keep things ticking over, you know, slightly differently from how Nuno does. But yeah, it's going to be it will be really interesting, and that is the gamble. That's why players are often reluctant to leave teams when, from a fan's point of view, you might be thinking, well, you're not getting enough game time. What's in it for you here? And look, that is really important for him and for all players. They just want to play above all, especially for him when there's the England consideration, and it must be agonising for someone like him who was very well thought of by Southgate, played a lot of games. He was a starter for England for a reasonable length of time. So to then know that when you're not playing games, you're missing out on things like the Euros, and for England, that's an additional consideration for someone like him.
I think Winks is one of those players who the timing of the Euros really counts against him, because, you know, he was in November 2019, the last international break before the Euros.
He scored, didn't he? He scored in that game.
Between him and Declan Rice, starting that holding role, but Winks had actually won his place back at that point.
I couldn't believe in Charlie's piece that Winks played for England in like November 2020, less than a year ago. It's mad.
Yeah, he came back for that in that first autumn back of kind of post-COVID, behind closed doors England games, and did play a bit. But by that point, Calvin Phillips was involved as the partner for Rice, and Winks kind of fell out of contention. But, you know, if COVID hadn't happened and the Euros had happened in 2020, then Winks would surely have gone.
He might even have started. I mean, he definitely would have gone, and he could easily have been a starter.
Yeah, given how he'd been playing. And even if you look at kind of England's best performance under Southgate, arguably, the 3-2 win in Seville in October 2018, I was lucky enough to be at that game. And Winks was playing midfield, but he wasn't holding. They actually had Eric Dier, of all people, holding. And so Winks was playing alongside Ross Barkley in quite an aggressive role. And he got so much running. Like, the thing about Winks is he's not just a kind of keeps it neat and tidy. Like, he used to have an amazing engine. It would really tear around the field pressing Spain, and he was so good in that game. And thinking back to it earlier, because that was, Charlie, you mentioned this in your piece, it was 3 weeks ago today, I think.
3 years ago, yeah.
He had all that energy, and I'm not sure I've seen him playing quite the same way. And I'm just wondering whether and this is just speculation, he's not quite been able to produce that same physical intensity since the various ankle problems that he had and the groin operation he had just before the Champions League final.
Yeah, which is so unfortunate. And you're right. I mean, because I was speaking to people about this and they reminded me that he used to play as a number 8 at academy level. Like, that was more his game. And in that Real Madrid game, the famous one in 2017, not the one at Wembley, the draw at the Bernabeu, where he was amazing. I remember watching that game thinking, like, he's just going to go on a Pochettino journey like we'd seen with Dele or Harry Kane or Eriksen, and just go up and up and up and up and become absolutely elite. And in that game as well, he did a lot of pressing high up the pitch. He could get around in a way that now we do see him more, or we think of him as more in that stationary, sit deep, pass it kind of role.
One other thing I want to mention is Michael Cox has done an interview with Glenn Hoddle talking about some of his favourite goals that he scored and his ideas about playing the game. It's really, really good. There's nothing quite like getting an all-time great player giving insight onto how he sees the game.
It is really good. It's really good. And you can tell reading it how much Hoddle's enjoying it. I mean, I guess who wouldn't enjoy luxuriating in watching clips of them being amazing? But he talked really interestingly about it.
My favourite bit, and only Glenn Hoddle could say this, is when he says, with all due respect to Cristiano Ronaldo, .. Yeah. There are very few people in football who would use that phrase, but Glenn Hoddle is definitely entirely believable that he would be one of them.
He genuinely, like watching those clips... And I just every time I watch it, I do feel that is one player I wish I could have watched play live. I mean, he is sensational. The stuff, and I love two-footed players. And that's nothing I generally do is when Coxie points out that he can score off either foot, and he says something like, "Yeah, I was doing that since I was 5." To be honest, like that just always came. And somehow, like I know he was perceived as arrogant or whatever, but I just think that's great. Just tell it like it is. Like don't be falsely modest about it when you're just absurdly gifted.
We're going to just wrap it up with some questions. These are some questions we've been sent in by some listeners this week. We're just going to go for Stephen Brewer's questions. I think, James, you'll especially enjoy these. So, listener Stephen Brewer...
Wow, he's really gone to town here.
Who was the better striker for us? Bobby Zamora, Ideker Johnson, or Fraser Campbell?
Is this bloke having a laugh?
I think, yes, he is. I don't think he actually thinks he's a pressing.
Ideker Johnson. I think Fraser Campbell and Bobby Zamora scored one goal, or maybe Fraser Campbell got a couple of goals in the League Cup. Actually,
he did against United.
Yeah, no, against Liverpool. You embarrass yourself.
Was it? Oh yeah, he came from United. I was thinking United.
Bobby Zamora scored one. It's got to be good Johnson. I think he was kind of assured. I think he only scored once. Maybe he might have scored a goal in the FA Cup. Actually, so he scored twice.
But Johnson, didn't he score that really good goal at Stoke for Spurs?
It's quite a big win that as well in that 2009-10 season. So yeah, we'll say good Johnson. But I mean, it's a low bar.
The best midfielder for us, Hossam Ghali, Kevin Prince-Boateng, or Adel Taarabt?
Adel Taarabt, right. I know there's this thing that he had this cameo against Derby County in 2007. And people go on about how great he was when he came on, but he was utterly rubbish. He's doing all his tricks and constantly giving the ball away. He was rubbish. Boateng, away at Chelsea, that same season, 2008, 2009, early in the season, one of the worst performances I've ever seen from a Tottenham player. He was absolutely dreadful. And Hossam Ghali actually was quite good. I know people hate him because he threw his shirt at Martin Yol, but he didn't play loads, but when he played a foot, it was not bad, so I would probably say Ghali.
Taarabt, when he was quite good, he came on in the North London derby when Berbatov scored that goal when Arsenal won 2-1, and he was actually very dangerous and should have been given a penalty. He was really tricky and it didn't get given.
He came on in the West Ham game, the 4-3 as well, where he won the free kick that Berbatov scored. But yeah, he was rubbish.
Okay, the best keeper for us, Ben Arnwick, Martin Fulop, or Lars Hirschfeld?
I'm not sure Fulop or Hirschfeld ever played in the first team. I could be wrong on Fulop. Hirschfeld definitely didn't. But Ben Anik was really rubbish. I mean, I think he might have played in one Premier League game at Burnley, the last game of 9-10, and he conceded 4, and I think 2 of them were quite bad goals. And he also played the second leg of the League Cup semi-final the following season, the season before against Burnley, and conceded maybe 3. Not great. So I'm going to say Martin Fulop, even though I don't think he played for Spurs.
I'd never heard of Lars Hirschfeld, I'm afraid.
I think he's Canadian, I think. Long-standing subkeeper in the sort of early 2000s.
Best left-back, Lee Yong-pyo, Eric Edmond, or Timothy Atuba?
Yeah, I think Lee Yong-pyo was fine. He was all right. Atuba probably wasn't quite as bad as people thought. He, like, dwelled on the ball a lot. I think he looked like he was going to make mistakes quite often, but very rarely did. And Edmond, I can't look beyond how badly he played for Wigan in that 9-1. So I will say Lee Yong-pyo.
Also, isn't Atuba's quite timely because he scored at St James's Park.
St James's Park, yeah, that's true. With his right foot. Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
The swinger.
So, yeah, there you go.
Stephen Brewer, thank you very much for your questions. If that was quite good fun. If anybody else has any questions like that, send them in for next time. That's all we've got time for on this week's podcast. Thanks to everyone for sticking with us for this long, if you have. If you're not already a subscriber, you can read all of our articles on Spurs by going to theathletic.com/SpursPod. And right now, you can sign up with a 33% discount on a full subscription. We will be back on Monday, looking back on the Newcastle game and ahead to next week. Thank you very much for listening.
The Athletic.